Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Is Delaware poised to become the next state to legalize recreational marijuana?
I'm hoping this is the year for us. I picked it up in 2019, but we've come up a couple votes short, so I'm hoping this year is different.
Our Roman Battalion looks at the prospects for a legalization bill coming to the General Assembly. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also check in on this year's beach rental market as the COVID pandemic still factors into people's vacation planning. And hear about a new opportunity DSU students studying quantum science are getting. Art's playlist introduces us to a Delawarean getting back to his musical roots. And Enlighten Me highlights more student journalism from high school students. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Previous efforts to legalize recreational marijuana in Delaware failed to gain traction. But with nearby states heading in that direction, the first state is feeling some pressure to move on it now or miss out on tax revenue. Delaware Public Media's Roman Battalion reports a bill to legalize recreational cannabis is coming to the state legislature, and this time could actually pass.
Delaware's lawmakers have been trying to legalize recreational marijuana since 2017, but have lacked enough support. Democratic State Representative Ed Ozinski is now the lead sponsor on recreational marijuana.
So I'm hoping this is a year for us to get my bill passed, which actually started several sessions ago with Senator Henry and Representative Keeley, and I picked it up in 2019. But we've come up a couple votes short, so I'm hoping this year is different.
Legal marijuana isn't completely new to the state. Delawareans might notice one of six compassion centers throughout the state, which offer cannabis to medical patients. A bill legalizing medical marijuana passed 10 years ago now, and signed by then-Governor Jack Markell. But according to Zoe Patchell from the Delaware Cannabis Advocacy Network, that didn't mean smooth sailing for medical marijuana users.
We formed in 2013, just after that measure had passed. However, the state was still not fully implementing the 2011 law. They began issuing medical cannabis cards to patients. However, there were no dispensaries open for the patients to have safe, legal access to their medicinal cannabis. So one of the first things that we addressed was trying to fully implement that program, get the dispensaries open, and get the consumer safety protections for the medical cannabis patient.
The state's medical marijuana law stalled just after it was signed. Markell held off on actually implementing the law and permitting dispensaries to open. He cited a federal Justice Department memo suggesting it would prosecute anyone associated with the sale of medical marijuana, even in states approving the practice. So, marijuana users were able to get cards from their doctors, but there was no way for them to access the drug. The state's medical marijuana industry remained in limbo for almost 3 years before Markell finally started the process of opening dispensaries after the Justice Department backed off from enforcing marijuana legalization. The first dispensary opened the summer of 2015. First State Compassion opened in Wilmington, and more soon followed. And as of last year, there are over 16,000 medical marijuana users in the first state, a number that continues to grow every year. The state also decriminalized the drug back in 2015, albeit with concessions. Decriminalizing meant most marijuana possession cases turned into civil fines. But for many cannabis advocates, medical marijuana and decriminalization are just stepping stones on the way to full legalization of the drug for everyone. Almost all states that legalized marijuana started out with medical cannabis, and many decriminalized the drug. Advocates such as the Cannabis Advocacy Network have been pushing state lawmakers to bring recreational marijuana to the state, and they believe the arguments and momentum are on their side. State Auditor Kathy McGinnis released a report last month highlighting what legalizing recreational cannabis could mean for the state's coffers. McGinnis's report found Delaware's cannabis market size could be higher than $250 million and create thousands of jobs in the state. And, according to McGinnis, that's just the bare minimum.
We had a conservative estimate. So if more people decide to use it, or if people decide to spend more money than the average, which we said was about $2,000 per user, that number could easily go up.
For example, McGinnis's report only cites around 13% of Delawareans use marijuana, which came from a 2015-16 study by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. That number only reports people willing to say they use cannabis, meaning it's likely a conservative estimate. And now, nearby states are starting to legalize it. Neighboring New Jersey approved recreational pot during the 2020 election, and enabling legislation to move that process along was signed this week. So legal weed is coming to the Mid-Atlantic region, and Patchell says if Delaware doesn't hurry up, much of that revenue could head to the Garden State.
Those consumers want to make sure that they have a safe product. They want to make sure that their cannabis is safe and free from contaminants and other harmful additives. So I imagine if Delaware doesn't take immediate steps to legalize and convert our pre-existing market into a legal market, there's going to be a lot of individuals who end up patronizing the New Jersey market to ensure that the cannabis that they're consuming is safe and that the product has been tested and is well labeled.
Legalizing marijuana doesn't appear to be held back by Delawareans themselves. According to a 2018 University of Delaware poll, 61% of people in the state support legalizing marijuana. But it isn't up to Delaware voters, at least directly. Delaware doesn't have ballot initiatives or referendums beyond school district funding, and the legislature can pass constitutional amendments without voter approval, which is unique to the first state. So it's up to lawmakers in Dover, and getting marijuana legalization approved through state legislatures is the road less traveled. Among the 14 states that legalized recreational marijuana so far, only two, Illinois and Vermont, did it through their state legislatures. All other states took the decision to the voters. But lawmakers backing pushing for legalization believe it can happen here this year. A bill legalizing recreational cannabis is expected to be introduced in March by Ozinski. It failed last session in part because it lacks support of supermajorities in both chambers. Since it involves a tax, it requires two-thirds support, 25 votes in the House and 13 in the Senate. Ozinski says this year, some changes were made to the bill after talks with marijuana advocates, mostly focused on supporting the state's minority communities. According to the ACLU, black people are four times as likely to be arrested for possession of marijuana in Delaware, which is higher than the national average. This has been the case for decades, and advocates say just legalizing marijuana isn't enough. There should be reforms that seek to repair the damage done to minority communities so disproportionately affected. Ozinski says he's worked with advocates to address concerns surrounding racial justice while creating space for small businesses to compete in the market.
We have heard that currently around the country, there's a lot of like hedge fund investors and big marijuana companies, and it kind of blocks out the local entrepreneur. So we've decided to try to address that with like a micro business or a craft business license, and also a carve out for social equity applicants, which they'll get some additional help with applying and some reduction in fees.
Ozinski says his team looked at other states' recreational cannabis programs for ideas. Colorado, Michigan, and Arizona all have specific social equity licenses. While the specifics haven't been laid out in the Delaware bill yet, in Michigan, to qualify for a social equity license, individuals or groups receive a reduction in fees if they live or plan to operate in a disproportionately affected community or have been arrested for marijuana possession in the past. The craft business license allows more vertical integration. Craft license owners will be able to grow, manufacture, and sell their own product. Usually those licenses are given out separately. Ozinski says this would encourage a sort of Budweiser versus Dogfish Head style competition, and adds many marijuana users enjoy the innovation that comes out of craft and small businesses. But even with these changes, opposition remains. One long-standing opponent of this legislation is the law enforcement community. Jeffrey Horvath is the executive director of the Delaware Police Chiefs Council. He says often, legalizing weed doesn't live up to the promises cannabis advocates make. He says he's learned a lot from talking with other chiefs out in Colorado, the first state to legalize pot back in 2012.
You know, one of the chiefs out in Colorado, when he was doing a presentation, he said, if you're going to fight anything in this recreational marijuana bills that are coming to your states, fight the edibles, because we've had more problems with those than anything.
And that debate and others will play out in Dover. Ozinski says his bill could be filed any day now.
We're going to try to get that out to my colleagues so they can see what's actually in the bill, and then I can start getting my head counts on my votes. And hopefully when we get back in March from JFC break, we'll get this in committee, released from committee, and scheduled on the House floor.
And Ozinski is optimistic with a more progressive legislature in place following November's election. The votes are there to get legalization over the finish line in the first state. Roman Battaglia, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Roman. And stay with us. The Green continues with a look at this year's beach rental market as the pandemic continues to loom over people's vacation plans. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. COVID-19 cases and hospitalizations continue to trend down, and the state is trying to ramp up vaccine distribution. That, combined with loosening pandemic restrictions on businesses, restaurants, and indoor gatherings, offers hope that there might be a light at the end of the COVID tunnel. And that hope seems to be reflected in summer beach rentals. Contributor Eileen Delabrida offers a look at the vacation rental market in her latest piece, available at DelawarePublic.org. And she joined me earlier this week to discuss what she learned about how things are shaping up for those looking to get away after a year of largely hunkering down. So how is the rental market shaping up, Eileen? One would think with people having been in isolation under pandemic restrictions for almost a year now that there's got to be some pent-up demand to get out and go somewhere. What is availability like right now?
It's very tight. People are booking early, and they are booking longer. They are, I guess, so used to working remotely that they want to do it at the beach.
And your piece indicates that there are some things that people are looking for that are a bit different than in the past. What's changing on people's wish lists kind of based on where we stand right now with the pandemic?
Well, besides wanting to rent for multiple weeks instead of one or two, the first question agents tell me that people ask is there a high-speed internet connection available? Because so many people will be working remotely while they're at the beach. They are also looking for really big, fully equipped kitchens so that they can cook there more and dine out less. And also, they want to bring their pets with them, especially their dogs, just because so many people are planning to be there longer. They just want to be in a place that is not home. They're tired of being at home.
Yeah, and I guess in some ways, if you take 2 weeks, you could take 1 week's vacation. If you have that right internet connection you were talking about, you could kind of be working remotely, but still be kind of on vacation, which is an interesting thing that I don't think a lot of people had thought about in the past.
Yeah, that's what we're seeing. Plus, property owners have changed some of their procedures. They have electronic keypads, so there's to avoid that handoff of house keys. They are bringing in cleaners that are misting the properties, disinfecting them between guests. COVID's had a huge impact on the rental market.
So let's talk a little bit about cost. I mean, you mentioned in your piece that rentals are on record pace compared to what was a record pace last year. Are property owners able to cash in on the demand? What can people expect to pay compared to maybe what they're used to paying?
They will be paying more, but not a lot more. It seems that that the landlords are resisting the temptation to see whatever the market will bear. But the prices have gone up a bit.
You mentioned earlier that it appears people really want to stay close to home at this point. And that desire appears to be strong enough to kind of overcome deals that are being offered to go elsewhere, correct? There are other places people would normally go, and some of those places are trying to draw people, but people aren't biting?
Well, I think that people are depending on their comfort level, but their comfort level is still not high. For example, the resorts in the Caribbean and Mexico are offering deep discounts and on-site testing and things like that. But they are not getting the response that they had hoped for because we have been with this pandemic for a year now. And I think the fact that we might be in the home stretch has given people the will that we're almost there. Let's not blow it now.
Yeah, I was going to say, perhaps this year is a baby step and you just push off that bigger vacation to, say, a resort or overseas to a year from now.
That is why agents tell me that that landlords aren't taking a few weeks for themselves. They know that that next year probably won't be as robust for them because people will want to go other places. People that who have been putting off trips to Europe or to the West Coast or places that you would fly to will want to be traveling there. And I think it's also contributing to the fact that while we're seeing some price increases, that we aren't seeing gouging because those landlords want to maintain a good relationship with renters.
So we've talked about this idea of maybe not going too far this year. How safe is it to travel? What is the CDC saying about getting around? Do people have reason to be reluctant to travel so far, other than just not wanting to blow it?
Well, travel does increase our risk of getting COVID. And so at the top of the list, as far as CDC recommendations go, is stay home. Next on the list is short trips by car with members of your household. Don't stop for food. Don't stop for gas. Don't stop for a bathroom break. So that would be, you know, just a few hours away, which I think is one of the reasons why the beach is such a popular destination. And then after that, we have the long car trips where there's lots of stops for food and gas and bathroom breaks and travel by trains and buses, which is difficult because it's really hard to maintain a distance of 6 feet between your fellow right. travelers. And there is, with air travel, there is an additional layer of risk because you have to run the gauntlet of security at the airport terminal.
So how about day trips or shorter visits to places other than the beaches? Do we have any indication that the reluctance to travel or take those longer trips with more risk is making these options a little bit more popular this year as well?
Oh, yes. The folks at the Greater Wilmington Convention and Visitors Bureau who visits their Facebook page and their Instagram accounts have seen a huge spike in locals, people who aren't from outside the area looking for things to do that are close to home. So that's all been very good for places like Mount Cuba that was recently named the best botanical garden in America by USA Today. And also just little kind of out of the way places like covered bridges in northern Newcastle County that your family can hop in the car and maybe pack a picnic lunch and go and see them. You can take a walking tour on your own. Download your tour and your guide on your smartphone. Put on your mask and go.
It does look like people are going to still be kind of innovating a little bit in what they do for their vacations this year and just kind of holding off just a little bit more. But clearly the message here is that people do want to get out and do something, right?
They do. It's been a long time, and folks, they do want to get out. I think especially now that it's winter and we've all spent so much more time inside, at home, not social distancing outdoors, that people are really hungry for spring and summer, and they want to get out there and be on the move again.
Thanks to contributor Eileen Dalabrida for her time this week. Her piece on summer vacation rentals is available at DelawarePublic.org. Next, we learn about a new opportunity for DSU students in the quantum science field. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Delaware State University joins a list of historically black colleges and universities partnering with IBM in a quantum education and research initiative. This comes months after DSU received a Department of Defense grant to start its own Center of Excellence in Advanced Quantum Sensing. Delaware Public Media's Nick Schellino recently spoke with the director of that institute, DSU Professor of Physics and Engineering, Gore Potsy, about what this means for the university and its students.
All right, so it looks like DSU is among 10 institutions who are joining this IBM HBCU Quantum Center for a total of 23 institutions. Can you start by explaining what this is?
Yes, so IBM is investing in the quantum computing area. IBM currently has a quantum computer which is on the cloud, and so it's launching a new IBM HBCU Quantum Center, which is going to support and facilitate quantum research and education for HBCU faculties and students as part of the growing quantum workforce.
And how does this connect to DSU's grant that the institution recently received, $7.5 million for to create its own Department of Defense Center of Excellence for quantum research?
So four months back, we got this grant from DoD to create a new Center of Excellence in Advanced Quantum Sensing. And as part of this center, we will offer new courses for undergraduate and graduate students at DSU in this area of quantum science, quantum information processing, and quantum computation. So students who will do these courses will have access to the IBM quantum computer, which is on cloud, and then they will also learn and develop how to write quantum algorithms using the IBM open source programming kit. So that is our interest, and it will enhance our educational curriculum that we propose as part of the center.
Can you talk a little bit more in detail about quantum research and what it actually entails for students?
For students, we envision that, when they do the coursework at DSU, so they would have access to the IBM quantum computer. And so besides that, IBM also has a lot of other educational support for the students to learn quantum computation. But from a research side, we still haven't figured out, but some of our faculties are interested in doing collaborative research with IBM. So that will happen later.
Can you maybe give more of a sense of what it means to have access to the cloud and what students will be doing in the classroom?
They will learn quantum computing as part of this course, but for example, using IBM quantum computer, they can do some programming on the quantum computer, and quantum computers are programmed differently than the conventional computer. So IBM is giving that access. Without that access, the students will not be able to use the computer, so the IBM quantum computer. So, and then they have a toolkit, so they have a particular type of programming language that the students need to learn when they want to do that quantum computing programming.
Why is this important for DSU and HBCUs more broadly?
One of the things that nation as a whole is so quantum computing is advancing very fast. Quantum computing is important for many different reasons. So some of the tasks that the quantum computer can perform cannot be done using this conventional classical computer. So there's a so we need to build this workforce for the future, and since it is advancing very fast in the near term, there will be a lot of demand for job opportunities for students. So part of our goal is to create this new workforce in this science area. So and it is not so common in HBCU institutions. So I think this kind of collaboration gives us unique opportunities.
Thanks to DSU Professor of Physics and Engineering, Gaur Patti, and our Nick Schellino for their time on The Green this week. And The Green continues in a moment with Arts Playlist, where we meet a Delawarean trying to restart his singing career. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. The president of Kent County Code Purple is reviving his singing career, at least part-time. Enyo Emmanuel put his career on hold 5 years ago to work in philanthropy full-time. Now he feels a pull to focus again on his musical outlet and has released his first English music video called Don't Mean That I Don't Love You. On this week's Arts Playlist, he chats with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about the song and video and getting back to his musical roots.
Normally, we talk to you about Kent County Code Purple, and, you know, you do a fantastic job running that organization, finding the homeless, shelter. The organization has come a long way. But today we're talking to you for a very different reason. I did not know until about a week ago that you could sing. Why am I just learning this?
I think for me, I used to do it full-time as a profession like 5 years ago. And so I took, working in the nonprofit sector and just trying to do, I think philanthropy for me was something that really just, you know, it fulfills me. And so music kind of just ended up falling on the back burner when I started doing more philanthropy. But I think as I started getting more and more and more involved in helping people who, you know, are addicted to drugs or alcohol abuse or what it may be, I started to realize that I needed my outlet still. And so I came back to music and got back with my team. And I was like, I need music. I need like this to keep me like a hobby. You know, before it was more, you know, I did it and it was fun and I've worked and I've toured. And now it has like a deeper meaning because it's really like a release and a moment for me to kind of get my mind off of a lot of the things that are happening in the world and of the people that I help. And it refocuses me, and then I come back and I'm stronger and can do more. And you know, and so now I'm just, you know, I'm mixing it together. And also I think a part of it was I started to realize that in the music industry, I used to live in Los Angeles for 7 years. And in the music industry, I find that a lot of people are happy, but sometimes it's just what they you see. And behind that, sometimes there's other things going on. And so I think a lot of my friends in the music industry want to do more work for, you know, people who are in need or homeless. And I started connecting with people, and now people are helping me. You know, I have some homeless guests that are getting free music to record to, free studio time, some consulting. And so, through me doing music again, it kind of just also helped me revive some of the lives of my friends who are in the music industry because I give them opportunities to serve.
So you just released this new music video. It's called Don't Mean That I Don't Love You. Let me just say right now, it is fantastic. When you released this, I kept watching it and listening to it over and over and over for like 2 days straight. I think it's fantastic. I'm sure the general public and our listeners will think it's fantastic, too. Where did you come up with the title, Don't Mean That I Don't Love You?
I wrote it, you know, about 6 years ago, I wrote this song, actually. And it was around the time that I was traveling, you know, on the road 4 to 5 days a week. And so I was away, from my exes. I was away from my family. it was just a moment where I felt like I was having very triumphant success in my professional life, but my personal life, when it comes to people I loved, I think they felt like I was leaving them in the dust. And it wasn't the case at all. You know, they knew, everyone around me was supportive and was helping me move forward. But there were times where people, I felt like resentment, because, you know, sometimes people don't understand why you would go after a music career or a career in entertainment if they're not doing it themselves. And so the song was just a message to be like, you know, even though I'm living a very busy life, and even though I can't always be there for you the way maybe you're there for me or you're there for other people because of time, which I can't buy more of, you know, I still love you.
That is fantastic. Where did you record it?
I recorded it in Delaware. I actually have a studio at my house, so I record at home a lot, and then I mixed it with a gentleman named Nick Grasset, who's actually also from Delaware. And then I mastered it with a gentleman called Austin Hall from Florida.
Where can people find this music video? Because everybody at this point is saying, Kelly, tell us where we can find it.
Well, you can go, if you look on YouTube and you search Don't Mean That I Don't Love You, or Enyo, E-N-N-I-O, Emmanuel, you'll find it on YouTube. And then if you just want to listen to the song, you can get it on iTunes and Pandora and Spotify and add it to all your playlists. And I have, you know, I'm really excited, and just comment and send me any messages of what you think. You know, it's a great song. You know, even sometimes I have the song after recording it now and after looking at the music video, it makes, I think of other things. You know, sometimes working with Code Purple King County, sometimes there's individuals that you feel like you've let down because you're not able to solve their mental health crisis, you know, overnight. Or you're not able to do, you know, be super, sometimes I just want to be Superman and save everyone. And you know, that those things take time. And when you can't do that, sometimes you feel like you're not loving someone. But so the song can have really deep meaning, you know, for certain people in their lives that, you know, even sometimes people, I think they feel like they let God down. And so they're like, you know, God, you know, I'm not perfect, but it doesn't mean that I don't love you. And so those different meanings really grew with me. So when you're listening to it on YouTube or Spotify, Pandora, just know that all those type of ideas went through my mind when I'm hearing it as well.
I know how hard you work every day with Kent County Code Purple, and I know what that nonprofit means to you personally. So it's odd to me that you think that sometimes you let people down.
Yeah, I think in the world that we are in, there's always, you're expected to always be successful or always be, you know, on top of the bottom line and always having results. And if, you know, depending on who's measuring them or who you're trying to, show those results to. And for me, it's our community. I feel like we are, what is needed to help people isn't going as fast as the addiction problem, you know, people getting addicted or people going through mental health or depression. Sometimes I feel like, you know, you work daily, but, you know, those demons in people are also working daily and keeping them down. And I think last year we were so, we move on to Code Purple and talk about, you know, I was really worried because COVID-19 hit and you just didn't know where the community was. You know, a lot of people are still at home and they're not going out. But the homeless people and people who are in need, they have no choice. You know, they're outside no matter what. And so I think, every time I feel like I'm not a comp, we're not reaching the goal, something does happen that keeps me going. And so that's the good part about it. You know, I might see a lot of need, but I also see a lot of people working together. I see a lot of hope. I see people that are homeless or people that are low income, you know, they're working hard to get out of that situation themselves. So that keeps me going. But sometimes, you know, I feel, you know, I want to save everyone. And that has a lot that has not a lot to do with someone's personal family, someone's personal trauma, personal background. And so, you know, until I learn enough about the human brain and the human life, I will probably always feel like I'm not, you know, I'm laying someone down because I don't understand exactly where they're coming from. But I'm getting better. I'm learning a lot more, you know, just over the last year working with Code Purple as president really has grown my mind. And so I'm just looking forward to learning more about people, learning more about their past, learning more about their trauma, and helping them identify ways to overcome and be the person that they were born to be. And so I don't know if I'll ever feel like I'm 100% like, ooh, I'm, you know, we're, I don't, I'm not letting anyone down. But I do know that that emotion in me isn't a bad one. You know, I don't, doesn't make me like sad, but it makes me want to do more and to make sure that I'm always on my toes and always realizing that there's someone, you know, if we think we've helped a lot of people, there's always still someone missing. And that's the, and that's where my heart is to make sure we don't leave anyone behind and that everyone knows that there's someone out there that's about, you know, that's rooting for their best life and loves them, you know, aside from their differences, aside from whatever it may be in their life that other people might call them weird or, you know, people that we shouldn't pay attention to. I want them to know that they have purpose. And until I feel like everyone knows that, I'll just be keep, you know, preaching and trying to get out there and just tell people that there's hope in the world.
We want to remind everybody, first off, we're talking to the president of Kent County Code Purple, but we're not talking to him for that purpose specifically today. We are talking to him because he's got a new music video out. It's called Don't Mean That I Don't Love You. I'm going to put you on the spot. Do you want to sing a few bars for us?
Yeah, I mean, I knew you were going to say that. I knew that. I think you're probably going to ask me to sing. I'll sing the chorus.
Go right ahead.
You know you've been on my mind, and I've been out here on my grind. You know I'm not perfect, no, but that don't mean that I don't love you. There you go. A little bit.
That's fantastic. You are a great guy. Hey, what's in your future? What's next as far as your music?
Oh, for our music, we're working on a new music video. So we'll be, you know, I'm going to be pushing them out now on a very consistent basis. We are probably going to, you know, launch a podcast. Maybe I'm trying to do something that's really impactful that involves, you know, I have a lot of facets in my life when it comes to music and business and the nonprofit world. And so trying to find a way to mix all those together is, you know, takes some intelligence. So we're working on that. But I'm going to keep releasing music videos and, you know, hopefully get ready for another tour and just use music as a way, as a vessel to keep, you know, moving the message of helping out the community. And so I think you're just going to see my music career kind of go side to side with my nonprofit work in the future and hopefully, you know, make it grow into a music academy or something like that here in Delaware where I live and just make Delaware better. I'm all about it right now. I'm pretty invested in Delaware as a musician, as a singer, as a nonprofit worker and businessman too. And so I think just going to keep doing music, getting ready for a tour, hopefully do some, you know, if you follow the YouTube channel, you'll see, you can YouTube Enyo World is the page, Enyo World. And we'll probably be doing some live shows on there and just keep it moving. I think the future is in our hands and we're in new times and I think it's that's why I started doing music again. I said, well, this is the time to just do something new and keep it going and then, you know, if I can make people in the music industry help me with the nonprofit world, then I know that it's a door that I should keep walking down.
Thanks to Enyo Emanuel and our Kelly Steele for their time on this edition of Arts Playlist. You can check out Emanuel's video for Don't Mean That I Don't Love You at DelawarePublic.org. And we wrap up The Green Next with Enlighten Me, where we return to Mount Pleasant High School and WMPH for more samples of student journalism being produced there. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thank you. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. We've been spending time on The Green recently highlighting work from student journalists at both the high school and college levels. Delaware Public Media partners with McCain and Mount Pleasant High Schools in the Red Clay and Brandywine School Districts to expose students there to radio journalism. Delaware Public Media reporter and youth media producer Sophia Schmidt leads that collaboration for us. And this week's Enlighten Me, we return to the radio career pathway at Mount Pleasant and WMPH to hear stories from a trio of students about life during the pandemic. While many students are back at school now in hybrid learning models, the COVID-19 outbreak over the past year has not only robbed them of their in-school education at times, but forced them to face many other obstacles. Emily, a junior, examines their struggles when school was forced solely online.
In early March, many high school students from the Brandywine School District believed they were just given a 2-week break while the state enforced a stay-at-home order. We were all excited, but little did we know that would be our last day in the building for over 10 months. Virtual learning was first introduced during the end of the 2020 school year, where teachers had the choice to hold Zoom meetings. Now, in the current school year, Zoom meetings are mandatory for every class, every day. There have been many difficulties with virtual learning, from technology complications to miscommunications and the decrease of student-to-student socialization. Ethan, a junior from Mount Pleasant, says that students are also struggling with a lack of motivation.
To be fair, I get to wake up a lot later, so that's always a positive. But I usually get up, I don't get dressed, I usually don't even eat. I'll just wake up at 7:55 and just log on and sit through my first period, which is usually very tiring.
Jordan, another junior at Mount, agrees.
It's more chill than it would be at physical school, but it's like I have zero motivation to actually get up and do anything, so it's basically just laying in bed all day on school, and I just take naps in between classes, so it's not as productive.
There's many hurdles students face, not only during school. The pandemic has also greatly affected teen mental health. The 4-H National Council conducted a study of 1,500 teens in May. Around 70% said they felt depressed, anxious, or high-stressed, and 61% said the pandemic has increased feelings of loneliness.
Yeah, I think this is like one of my worst years for my mental health.
Ethan also says that he's unclear about what resources to help with mental health are available from the district.
I know that we had the social-emotional stuff, but we weren't actually like really told what it was, and like we weren't given much information on it. Whenever I ask my fellow students about it, no one, like, knows what it is. I don't really know anything of, like, other than that. I guess we're supposed to just talk to our guidance counselors or something.
Students are forced to adapt to many changes due to the new learning platform, and needless to say, the class load is a lot more than previous years.
The classes this year, the teachers have been giving so much more work, since, like, apparently you have more, quote-unquote, free time. So they're just giving so much, and it's just so stressful.
With hybrid learning starting up soon, many students, including myself, are looking forward to more in-person class time and socialization. The concern still stands for students that decided to continue remote learning. How will these students interact? Will at-home students still get the teacher's attention? What other challenges will students be forced to face? This is WMPH. I'm Emily.
Thanks to Emily for her reporting. One of the many struggles that students deal with learning at home is computer problems. And Jairus, a senior, takes a closer look at that issue.
The students receive their Chromebook laptops before school starts. When students open up their laptop, they might have some computer problems, like internet connection, bad audio, noises, the screen keeps on freezing, computer shuts down on its own, even though your laptop is charged up, kicking you out of Zoom calls and more. Aiden Triano is one of many students at Mount Pleasant High School having computer problems.
Sometimes my computer just decides that it doesn't want to work one day and it won't let me log in for whatever reason.
Aiden Triano says he knows some students that just decides to use their own laptops when they experience a Chromebook problem. He also tried to get a hold of the school IT department because his computer wouldn't log on. but IT was so busy because it was happening to many students at the same time. Mari Moore is the technology coordinator at Mount Pleasant High School. She says they receive many phone calls about Chromebook problems.
We actually have quite a few phone calls. I believe it was over 1,000 phone calls in the last few weeks of last month.
Mari Moore says she believes some Chromebooks models are more efficient for learning. She gives the example of a touchscreen version called a world-facing camera, which is better education for students because they can take a picture of a board, take notes, and more. She believes there's no point as far as getting a new Chromebook laptop because you're still going to have issues. Google Chrome is still Google operating system built to be lightweight and easy to use. This is Jairus, WMPH News.
Thanks to Jairus for his reporting. And finally, we know the difficulties many small businesses have faced during the pandemic. Kevin, a senior, focused on one of them in Brandywine 100.
Fairfax Hardware and Action Hardware are a small hardware store trying to compete against online and big box stores, all amid the COVID-19 pandemic. Stefan Grossman is one of the managers at Fairfax Hardware. He says they implemented procedures to prevent the spread of COVID-19 at Fairfax Hardware.
Other than that, it's more sanitizing. So use products that were provided as sanitized doorknobs and surfaces and cabinets and stuff like that. And then we started doing curbside just because of it. So like people can call in and ask for stuff that they need and then see if we got it. And then they just do their purchase that way. Like.
On December 14th, 2020, Governor Carney announced a 30% capacity on retail stores. Jeff Omers is the owner of Fairfax and Action Hardware. He expresses confusion how the 30% restriction was calculated.
The capacity for a retail store is the way they calculate it, and I'm not sure how that is you know, more than the general amount of customers we would usually have anyway. So 30%, while it sounds like a decrease for a retail store, it's not that much. We haven't had to restrict people many times.
Jeff notices that more people are coming to his small hardware stores due to sanitary conditions at a big box retail, or it's the more personalized shopping experience. Kevin, WMPH News.
Thanks to Kevin, Emily, and Jairus for enlightening us this week. A reminder that stories like these are part of Delaware Public Media's collaboration with the Brandywine School District at Mount Pleasant High School and its radio station WMPH, as well as the Red Clay School District at McCain High School and its radio station, WMHS. Our youth media producer, Sophia Schmidt, oversees this collaboration and worked on pieces like these with teacher Paul Wishingrad, who runs the career pathway we work with at Mount Pleasant. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributor Eileen Dalabrina, our student journalists at Mount Pleasant High School, Emily, Jairus, and Kevin, and Delaware Public Media's Roman Battalion, Nick Shalina, and Kelly Steele. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne saying thanks for joining us this week, and we'll see you again next week here on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.